Thanks very much, Gordon, and my thanks once again to the Paul Woolley Centre for the opportunity to participate in this conference. I've had the privilege of speaking at all four of the Centre's annual conferences. My previous three speeches were very much from the perspective of someone from a policy-making institution on how to detect risks to financial stability, how to respond, and what mix of skills you might need to do so. With this being the last conference of this type at the Centre, I thought it would make sense to talk a little bit about future directions for research. This is, after all, an academic conference. Before I get to that, I thought I should make a few comments about recent developments. The Reserve Bank has been closely monitoring emerging risks in property markets for some time now. At least some of the growth in housing prices since the middle of last year was a bit of catch-up from a period of weakness. Some increase in prices was to be expected given the current level of interest rates. And housing prices are still within the same range relative to incomes that we've seen over the past decade, albeit towards the top of that range. But if you look beyond the national averages and aggregates, risks do seem to have been building up in some parts of the housing market, specifically the investor segments of the Sydney and Melbourne markets. Currently, close to half of all net new housing finance is extended to self-declared investors rather than owner-occupiers. That share is noticeably higher than rental housing's share of the housing stock, even if you allow for a possible faster rate of churn in investor loans. Obviously, that can't continue forever. We raised this issue over a year ago in the September 2013 Financial Stability Review. It's a reason why, in the latest Financial Stability Review, we described the composition of the housing and mortgage markets as becoming unbalanced. Now, part of the anticipated effect of monetary policy is to induce more construction activity. Higher prices are the incentive you need to get that expansion, and that expansion is indeed happening. But it's worth noting, as we can see in this graph, that the vast bulk of new borrowing for investor properties is indeed to purchase existing properties. We talked about these issues at some length in the Financial Stability Review last month and last week before the Senate. I do not have anything new to add to what we've already said in the past few weeks. We obviously need to keep a close eye on market developments, including lending standards. Amongst other things, banks and other lenders need to consider the risks they're taking on, not just from individual loans, but from the collective effects of the lending decisions that they're making on the system as a whole. APRA is the regulator and supervisor of banks and other deposit-taking businesses in Australia. It has already been turning up the dial in its supervisory activities in this area, though this might not have been obvious to observers outside the regulatory community and the institutions that are being regulated. As has already been described publicly, APRA is consulting with the Reserve Bank and with the other members of the Council of Financial Regulators about additional steps that could be taken to reinforce sound lending practices. In doing so, it will balance the advantages and disadvantages in the context of financial system stability, safety, and efficiency, and it will consider how those measures can best be targeted. Now, everything I've mentioned so far today is entirely consistent with the existing framework for financial stability policy in Australia. APRA has the mandate to use its powers to promote financial stability. It can take a holistic approach to risk. It can and does coordinate with other regulators. So what I'm describing here is very much in keeping with the state of mind of macroprudential policy that I described in my speech here to this conference in 2012. Authorities in many countries have looked to prudential and supervisory measures as part of the policy response to financial risk. Different countries have designed their responses differently according to the institutional arrangements they have and the specific risks that they face. In doing so, they've found relatively little existing theory to draw upon in the academic literature. And that's where you come in. And broadly speaking, it's the topic of the remainder of my talk today. It's been said that the global financial crisis was also a crisis for macroeconomic theory. New models and new approaches are required, so it's claimed. I honestly don't think I can add much new to that discussion. Economists far more knowledgeable and eminent than me have had quite a bit to say on this recently. Some of the participants in that debate have argued that the problem with mainstream theory was that it assumes that people have rational expectations. I absolutely agree that we need more research into the biases that pervade human behaviour. But I'm not so sure that rational expectations is the first assumption we should throw out of the standard models. The standard models that were being taught in graduate schools, those coming under the umbrella label of DSGE models, didn't just assume that people were rational and forward-looking. Most of them also assumed that there was a representative agent who was infinitely lived and who had full information about the structure of the economy. Or in other words, you're the only person in the world, you're going to live forever, and you know everything. It might be a reasonable way to model an economy comprised entirely of teenagers. But I think it might have some serious shortcomings when analysing the economy we actually have. I can now tell who the parents are in the audience. More seriously, though, without some diversity of actors in the model, some diversity of beliefs, there are no financial markets, no borrowing, no lending behaviour. Now, it's true that many mainstream macro models didn't contain financial sectors or admit the possibility of financial crises. They were built to answer different questions, and that's okay. No one model can do everything. It doesn't mean that policymakers were unaware of the importance of financial factors. Some of the most senior policymakers had been authorities on financial frictions and crises in their academic lives. And there were plenty of crises to remind us that crises matter. In fact, in the lead-up to the crisis, two of the most frequent policy debates were, first, what to do about so-called global imbalances, and second, whether and how monetary policy should respond to asset prices. So we were definitely thinking about these things. And they weren't just conversations amongst policymakers. There was plenty of serious academic work being published on these topics during the pre-crisis period, often using more or less mainstream models. Many of these papers were written by distinguished academics and published in top journals. These papers had welcoming audiences. If you wanted to work on these topics, nobody was stopping you. I've read some reports of sniggering in seminar rooms, not in Australia, thank goodness, sniggering in seminar rooms when people presented papers that were outside that mainstream macro model kind of framework. Let me assure you that good papers on financial stability topics had interest and respectful audiences at central banks and international agencies long before the crisis. So if the core mainstream models couldn't be used to investigate financial crises, it wasn't because they were inherently limited. It was because, like Jessica Rabbit, they were drawn that way. That was a choice of the modellers. It comes down to the questions they were trying to answer. So perhaps the real issue is not so much whether our models and theory needed to change, but why mainstream macro theory was not more interested in financial crises and financial stability issues generally. Well, nowadays, of course, there is a lot of interest in the subject. Whatever the methods that people use, it's an incredibly exciting time to be researching topics related to financial stability. Indeed, never before have there been so many interesting questions to pursue, yet so little time for us policymakers to pursue them ourselves. Even more exciting is that it's a game that many people can play, and not just economics and finance types. For example, I think that there's a lot that sociologists and organisational psychologists could have to say about why the major global banks take the risks they do. And because we know that so much of the financial stability policy framework centres on communicating and warning about risk, I would love to hear from academics in the field of communications about whether we could be doing it better. Please, let me know. Drop me an email. So how should academics interested in financial stability topics approach the subject? Now, Some observers have suggested that what we need is better models of asset price bubbles. Honestly, I'm not so sure that this is the first priority. I just don't see asset markets as having an on-off state, bubble or no bubble. There will always be some speculators in any asset market, more so at some times than others. And even in the hottest market, there'll always be some people buying for completely non-speculative reasons based on expected dividends or the suitability of the home or whatever other fundamentals are important to them in the context of that particular asset. This kind of diversity is particularly relevant in property markets where every property is different in some way. Even if prices seem overinflated in general, there can always be a well-priced property somewhere. On a more practical level, as I've explained previously, asset prices can go through boom-bust cycles that seem completely in line with fundamentals like rents, if those fundamentals are also cyclical. Busts of this type can be just as painful as the bubbly sort. Another limitation of a bubbles-focused approach is that your estimate of the bubble is only as good as your model of fundamentals. And unfortunately, many models of fundamentals are pretty limited. And in particular, many of them implicitly assume the same single-agent structure that's so problematic for macroeconomic models. Look, perhaps a more productive approach might be to think of asset markets as having many different types of trader operating in them, some more speculative than others. Models with different types of trader have a long-standing place in the literature, and I think there's a lot more that could be done in this vein. So rather than focusing on bubbles specifically, I'd like to take a step back and suggest a couple of guidelines that I think are likely to be important for staying on the right track when researching financial stability issues. First is get your stocks and your flows straight. I believe that no model will capture financial stability dynamics unless it incorporates stocks as well as flows into and out of them. You know, the obvious case is a balance sheet. If you're interested in a topic related to financial stability, tracking flows of income and expenditure is not enough. You must also track the underlying balance sheets, the debt, the liquidity position, leverage, and so on. And that's not a new insight. Goodness me, no. The role of balance sheets, and especially debt, was a central theme of work by people like Irving Fisher all those years ago, as well as Wynne Godley more recently, and many others. I'd go further than that and say that balance sheets are not the only stock that matters. Physical stocks of equipment, of real estate, or of particular types of capital goods, such as ships, can also be very important. Long-lived physical assets can experience large price cycles because their supply, a stock, is inherently sluggish. Speculative bubble dynamics are actually not required for a painful boom-bust cycle in asset prices. I've got an example, a bit of a personal anecdote really, that might help illustrate this point. Now, the recent financial crisis, as everyone should know by now, was sparked by a meltdown in the US mortgage market. Mortgage defaults started rising quickly long before unemployment did. Like, many countries had experienced booms in housing prices before the crisis. We all know that. But only a few had large subsequent increases in mortgage defaults. What was the difference? And only in the United States did defaults rise dramatically before unemployment rose rapidly. Why was that? I've discussed this elsewhere in some of my prior research. A lot of factors contributed, not least the utter breakdown in lending standards in the US mortgage market. But also crucial was the overbuilding, the build-up of a supply overhang. There's a good indicator of this in the US Census Bureau's share. It's got a series on the share of non-rental housing that's both vacant and for sale. It's the owner-occupier vacancy rate. You can kind of think of it like an unemployment rate for houses. The vertical line on this graph shows the December 2006 release, which was published in early 2007, before the financial part of the crisis had started. Now, over more than half a century, this vacancy rate had never before risen so high or so quickly. And it should be clear from this that the US housing market was in a different position to Australia's or the United Kingdom's or many other countries that had seen strong growth in housing prices up to that point. And I can tell you it was about the first month I started work at the Bank for International Settlements, and I was charged with looking at the global macroeconomy, and it was the first time I'd ever seen this particular data series. And obviously I only had it up as far as that vertical line. And I was pretty shocked, and I made sure that the senior management at Biz knew about it, because that was a pretty scary graph. Looking at the flow of building work wasn't enough to see the problem. United States had a supply overhang and was set for a larger downturn than those other countries. You had to look at the resulting stocks, not just the flows. Now, unfortunately, a lot of people miss this point. In all of the discussion, there's just not been that much recognition of this particular issue. And I think part of it might be because people are actually not accustomed to looking across multiple countries' experiences. But it's also because they forgot to look at the stocks as well as the flows. The second guideline I want to put before you is that you must allow for incomplete information, uncertainty, and thus default. Incomplete information is especially important when some people have information that others do not. From these asymmetries spring agency problems of the type that seem endemic in finance. Look, there's already a substantial body of literature on these issues, and I expect that it will be a fruitful area of research in future, particularly when one considers issues like organisational culture, fraud, and many other aspects of it. The specific possibility of default on a loan is a fundamental building block in any investigation of financial stability issues. People who borrow cannot know for sure that they will be able to repay the debt. They might expect and plan to do so, but some unexpected bad event might prevent it. Neither borrower nor lender knows for sure who will default. And while lenders might estimate a probability of default, they cannot observe it. Uncertainty about default induces lenders to impose constraints on how much they'll lend to a particular borrower. Now, again, this is all in much older and relatively mainstream literature, although perhaps in some cases not entirely mainstream literature. Some of these papers focused on companies as customers of the banking system, and others applied similar ideas to the banks themselves, allowing for the possibility of bank runs. So there are credit constraints. They take different forms, but often they boil down to working out how large a repayment the borrower can be expected to service. Credit constraints of this type have macro consequences, and in particular, they affect how we should interpret movements in certain macro-level quantities. If average interest rates fall, the loan amount that corresponds to that repayment is larger. Well, what's the macro consequence of this? Well, Australia went from being a high-inflation country to a low-inflation country in the early 1990s. One result of that was that average nominal interest rates fell, so the sustainable amount of debt rose relative to income. Permanently. People should therefore not expect ratios of housing prices or debt to income to revert to their long-run multi-decade averages. I don't know how many times I've written that in papers, in speeches, in comments back to certain international organisations over the past 20 years. Now, obviously, if we're wrong about this, we would love to know about it. But so far, no one has come up with a counter-argument to this idea, let alone a compelling one. Instead, what we see is some people confidently opining that property prices are however many percent overvalued. What's the model behind these statements? As far as I can tell, there never is a real model, only an assumption that if the national ratio of prices to incomes or rents is however many percentage points away from some multi-decade long-run average, it must revert to that average. Yet there's no theory that says it should work that way. Credit constraints matter, and if those constraints should change, say because of regulatory change or disinflation, then the sustainable level of these kinds of ratios will also shift. And you know, this state of affairs is not helped by data limitations in some other countries, which means that international agencies are making commendable efforts to have comparable data, but the best they can do is actually publish a ratio of price to income indexed to a long run average. It just really doesn't help. It's not their fault. I feel a little as though I've spent most of today's talk citing all the well-known seminal papers in this field. And they are the well-known seminal papers. The point I'm making is that none of this is completely new. The profession as a whole was not ignoring financial stability issues, even if the whole profession wasn't focused on it. Certainly some of the authors I've cited in the footnotes to this talk might have felt themselves to be outside of the mainstream of macroeconomics as it's taught in the top graduate schools overseas. I've deliberately sought to show today that these topics were being researched, were being published in top journals, and were getting the necessary attention from many policymakers. That said, it is a collection of work that didn't make it into those canonical macro models. More does need to be done on this front. Some of the most relevant ideas were coming from top academics, such as the ones I've cited today, who could hardly be said to be outside the core of the profession. Certainly, there are some other important insights coming from those who aren't big names. And there are some other quite big names whose influences are somewhat outside the graduate school canon. There's much to be learned from all these voices. Beyond the diverse voices of other in the fields of economics and finance, I think there's a lot to be learned from a different kind of other. Researchers in other fields entirely. Many of the issues relevant for financial stability analysis are quite difficult to tackle using standard economics models. And come on, it's hard enough to model a system with diverse kinds of atoms. It's even harder to model a system with diverse kinds of humans who think ahead and plan and mould their behaviour in response to what they think the other guy's going to do. Not trivial. There are so many interesting ideas in other fields. For example, I already mentioned the problem of assuming a single type of agent in the system. Recently, researchers in central banks and elsewhere have been using network models to obtain some useful insights on the structure of particular financial markets and relationships. Inherently, this means recognising you can't treat each market participant as being interchangeable with the others. Each of them will have a different set of relationships and therefore pose a different set of risks to the others and to the system. Networks have a long history in the mathematical literature, but they're relatively new tools in economics and finance. Another interesting angle comes from so-called agent-based modelling, which really aggregates up from the individual. The overall behaviour develops organically rather than assuming that the micro represents the macro. But when I titled this talk Learning from Others, though, I really did mean learning. Economics as a field is known for co-opting techniques from other disciplines. There's econophysics, ideas from evolutionary biology, ideas from geography. There are people looking at networks, searching for power laws, and many other ideas besides. But economics and finance will remain the fields with the most to say about financial stability. As we adopt these models and techniques, we have to be aware of their strengths and weaknesses and be mindful of using them in ways that are not misleading. We have to engage with the expertise in those other fields and learn from them. One of the great things about universities is that those multidisciplinary conversations can happen right here on campus. Unlike at central banks and international financial institutions, where almost everyone doing research comes from some variety of economics or finance training, at universities, there are experts in those other fields right down the hall or in the next building. Not all of their approaches and techniques will be appropriate for our purposes. We're much more likely to be able to tell the difference between the useful transplants and the less useful ones if we engage with the originating fields. Be wary of just reading a paper or two and thinking you understand a whole field or technique. So if I'm to articulate a vision of what research in financial stability topics could look like, it would be one of both continuity and change. I anticipate that many of the most useful ideas will be developed from existing ideas, especially those on asymmetric information and uncertainty. I also anticipate that some techniques adapted from other fields will prove fruitful, though there might be others that end up being dead ends for our purposes, no matter how useful they are in their original fields. And I anticipate that, try as I might, there will still be more interesting papers than policymakers like me have time to read. For that, I apologise. But I will try, because I'm looking forward to seeing what you come up with. Thank you very much for your time.
Totally ignoring Ian's warning earlier about seeking simple, explicit explanations for events, what's the simple, explicit explanation for that picture in, what was it, 06 or something?
US. It was overbuilding beyond the actual requirements of population growth. They had an enormous building boom, and if you just looked at the flow of building, you wouldn't have worked it out, because you also needed to know how much sort of housing they had, what their income growth was, what their population growth was. But bottom line, there was also a building boom, an enormous building boom, as well as a, partly enabled by huge easing in lending standards.
But it's the suddenness that makes me want to find an explicit, clear explanation for it, a Brady explanation. Did anything happen there?
That was when the spigot.
That died at the end of 03, and they started feeding through long-term rates a little bit later. This was the conundrum the Greenspan had. Mm. And I'm throwing it there.
But essentially, that was about when subprime and other mortgage default rates started rising. So basically that, you know, that building boom had been enabled, and that, you know, increasing rate of household formation had been enabled by a huge easing in lending standards. And the reason it became so problematic was because they actually managed to build up the oversupply. So you had a kind of an undershoot in housing prices, not just a reversion to where they'd been before.
in his book that he published in the spring, Tim Geithner, in his chapter on leaning against the wind, he makes the following observation. He says that there were teams, economist teams, at the New York Fed that were doing various scenarios analysis, and they were looking into what would happen if there was a 20% default rate on mortgages. And then they drew the conclusion that this was a containable risk and not something that needed to be of great concern. And pretty much everybody shared that view. Mm. So a lot of what happened there was a lack of appreciation of how a small loss can escalate into and balloon into a huge crisis. And so I was wondering what your take is on that, and whether you would like to see more research on that question.
Yeah, well, essentially stress testing. Can we do better with stress testing? Absolutely. It's a very rich and growing field. Essentially, part of the problem with stress testing is you're asking a model to say something about a range of data beyond where it's actually been estimated over. I mean, certainly in Australia, have we seen a 25 or 30% fall in housing prices? No, we haven't. We don't really know, and we know that there are important non-linearities. I have to say, Timothy Geithner's book is another of those things I have not yet had time to read. However, I mean, the pile is just getting crazy. There's so much good stuff coming out. However, I think one of my observations about what the US authorities were thinking at the time is they really were focused on the subprime piece. And what a lot of people didn't realize, even if you just look at the graph, the same data source, subprime and prime together, but you don't plot them on the same scale, you give them their own scales, the turning point was exactly the same. And I have to say, one of the crowning achievements of my career was the BIS annual report of 2007, where I demanded that we put "and other" when we started talking about it had subprime mortgage defaults. And I said, no, subprime and other. You've got to put "and other." It's not just subprime. And it's there in black and white in the BIS 2007 annual report that came out in the June of that year. And I'm going to claim that one, because it wasn't me who insisted on those two words. It was probably the best thing I've ever done. It's if you were overly focused on the subprime market, you missed what was actually going on. In fact, a lot of what was happening was sort of outside the subprime, but also outside the Fannie Freddie piece. It was the Alt-A, the jumbos, the IO loans. And, people just they thought it was contained to subprime, but it was actually much deeper than that.
After sharing with us your thoughts about the mess in the U.S., what can you say about the success in countries like Australia and Canada?
I don't want to sort of get drawn into, who's worked things better. I think another way of thinking about it is actually most countries didn't have a mortgage meltdown, and particularly countries where most of the lending is done by prudentially supervised agencies. you actually do get better. You historically, you've gotten better results. And I think that's certainly part of it. You know, prudentially supervised banks can still get themselves into trouble, but it's more often to do with commercial real estate and corporate lending than it is mortgages. And I think that's something a lot of people in recent years have forgotten. And it's something I'm quite worried that people are looking in all the wrong places.
One there, and we'll have to stop.
Yeah, so we were sort of looking at the crisis, but I guess we've now had, in the North Atlantic, at least 5 years of depression and no end to it. And a chronically depressed economy also seems to raise different problems, obviously, A, what to do about it, but B, how that interacts with, outstanding debt is a big part of the problem. How all that interacts. Is there anything interesting being done on how you deal with financial stability in a chronically depressed economy?
Well, I think my main comment there is it turns out that the old models that everyone teaches at undergraduate school turned out to be a pretty reasonable way of thinking about it, and that, you know, standard macroeconomic policy has the effects that we learned about in undergraduate school.
A picture like yours can be more useful than a model. It speaks very well. I saw one recently which compares Australia with other countries. Australia, banks in Australia, about two-thirds of its lending is for property. While in other countries, like Germany, Switzerland, it's only about one-third. Doesn't that show an imbalance in Australia about how the lending takes place?
It's a common misconception. I think it does tell you how difficult it is to assume that cross-country averages tell you something about imbalances. Yes, a lot of the lending that... The banking system in Australia does is mortgages, and that does mean that merely because of its size, as we said this in the financial system inquiry submission that we made, housing can pose a systemic risk merely because of its size, even though it's not particularly risky. But consider the alternative things that banks could get involved in. And, you know, German and Swiss banks were not lending in housing because they were lending to US housing through RMBS. They were lending to shipping companies. They were lending to hedge funds. I think I know which imbalance I'd rather pick.